Greetings and salutations, everyone. I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I am the NETC control operator for the Limark Technical Net. It's been going on for more than 43 years, and every Sunday night at 8 p.m., we find ourselves sitting in front of our radios, chatting with each other, advising each other, informing each other, learning from each other, hopefully entertaining each other. And once again, I thank you all for coming this Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we try and do it all over again. Let me drop for a second, then I will give you the usual links. Okay, if you want to reach me via email, that would be for mailbag questions. Those are questions normally asked during the TechNet, but if you're unable to get to a radio, you can email them to me and we can review them, and if they're interesting, we can discuss them on the air, and you can either listen to them via our audio stream on the Internet or our archive files. Or if you have a TechNet puzzle, we're always looking for technical puzzles that aren't easy to Google the answer for. That's a source for relearning things that we had forgotten. You can email them to me, and if I think I could fix it into a TechNet puzzle, I'd be more than happy to try. Or if you have expertise in a technical field that's in the news and you'd like to share it with us, we could put aside a little time for you to do a short little presentation on such technical aspects of the news. Or if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and have him take a look at a NASA space-related story that you found. Now, you could email him directly. His email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. But you can email me as well. My email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. I offer a link page of interesting articles, YouTubes, and what have you that I found over the last week. I cut and paste them, and I publish them every week, and they stay there available to be reviewed at any old time, a week from now, a month from now, even a year from now. So you know, if you have insomnia some night, yeah, you're in front of your computer screen, type into it, roy.ac2gs.com, and take a look at some of the link pages. I found them interesting, and I hope you do as well. We have a chat room available. Sometimes it's busy. Sometimes it's very, very quiet. You get there by typing into your browser, chat.ac2gs.com. As I mentioned earlier, we offer an audio stream of the Technical Net, but I keep it live the rest of the week. So, you know, if you're not within radio distance of the Glen Oaks repeater, but you're curious what's going on, type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll give you the audio stream. And as always, I like to remind people that MyKC2NJI has a great archive site. It's called amateurradio.tv. It has archives of the Limark Technical Net that go as far back as September of 2006. So avail yourself of the wisdom of brilliant hams that have moved away from the area. Some of them have become silent keys. So their wisdom continues to exist in the files of amateurradio.tv. So please avail yourself of that. Let me drop for a second, and I'll be back to tell you what we got planned for tonight. Okay, not a lot really important going on in artificial intelligence or anything else in the news that's of technical or scientific. I mean, there's a lot to talk about space, but I'll leave that for Paul to handle. So we will start with questions, topics, and comments. I hope that the early ones will be amateur radio related, but we will address any science or technology-based questions as best we can, and hopefully the audience will participate and expand our knowledge even further. That should take us approximately to 10:15. Paul WS2N will give us the SpaceNet report, which should last to approximately 11 o'clock. And I will return to tie a bow on everything and wish you well for the coming week. So that's the plan. If the laws of physics continue to work the way I understand them to, if my house and my shack and my computer and everything behaves and I don't get kicked off of All Star and the repeater behaves as well, That's the plan for tonight. Again, I want to caution people, especially the people who aren't listening, unfortunately, because they come late to the show, Annette, and then they get annoyed because they're not on the top of the list. So we're trying to make a list. We're trying to make it fair. We do make adjustments if people do show up late or they're really they don't have the time to sit and wait their turn. But keep in mind that the best approach is to show up at the beginning and put your name in relatively first and then get it over with that way. So hopefully no one will be upset that they're missed or lost and we run out of time because there is a limited time to everything, including the technical net. So with all that in mind, as I mentioned before, I'm AC2GS. This is the Limewire Technical Net, and we're open for business. If anyone has any questions, comments, or topics, and would like to go on the list, just hit that push to talk. Give me your call sign, your first name, and what you got for us tonight, and we'll put you on the list. So here it goes.
And to AXN, I'm radio related.
West recognized. Anyone else care to put your name on the list for tonight?
Alpha, ham radio related. My name's Mike.
Okay, Mike, could you give me your call sign one more time, please?
KE2EZA.
Okay, Mike, I got you on the list. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight?
W2BZ, non-ham radio.
Okay, Rich recognized. Anyone else care to put their name on the list for tonight? Okay, I'm sorry, but that's about 95% noise. Any way that you could boost your signal, move your antenna, kick up the outputs, the power or something so that I could hear you?
Not really, unfortunately. I'm on a handheld. It's N2NSG.
Okay, that time I heard you perfectly.
Roger that. Name is Matt, Glen Cove, New York, and just checking in. Thanks for doing the task tonight. Appreciate that.
Oh, okay, so you don't have any question or topic for tonight?
No, just checking in. I will make one remark. I did just set up an 80-watt small wind link node with Vera FM and packet, so it's open public. You guys are welcome to use it, and hopefully it works out.
Okay, very good. Thank you. I haven't used WinLink in more than a few years, but I'm glad to hear that you're providing it for your fellow hams.
Roger that. Appreciate everything, and be safe with this weather we're having. And 73, have a good night.
Okay, very good, Matt. Thank you. Anyone else want to put their name down on the list? Please, hit that push to talk.
Can you just turn it over to me?
No, Rich, I didn't really turn it over to you. I just asked if anyone else wanted to be on the list, and you doubled with someone else. So the other person, other than Rich, what did you, could you repeat what you just said?
My apologies for doubling. N2WGD, November 2, Whiskey Golf Delta. Just checking in and listening.
Okay, very good. Wesley, do you mind, because usually your stuff takes up a wee bit more time than the average other check-in. Do you mind if we push Mike and Rich in front of you for tonight?
Absolutely, go do it. No problem at all.
Okay, so Mike, what's your question or topic for tonight?
Hi guys. I am a brand new technician. Just got my license on Friday, and I'm exploring. I have a little handheld radio right now, and I'm exploring different antenna options. My question was about through window antennas. I understand that people use those on cars, and they can go through the glass without having to make any openings or anything like that, but it also uses the car as a counterpoise, which I don't fully understand what that means. I kind of understand what that means, I think. But anyway, I was wondering if I were to use one of those antennas in my apartment window, would it work? Would it be less effective without a big piece of metal behind it? Yeah, that's my question. Back to you, Net Control.
Okay, you kind of got two different antennas that you brought up. Primarily, I think what you're discussing more is what's called magnetic mount antennas that work for cars, because most car shells are ferromagnetic, and so they'll stick to it, and they use the metallic body of the car as the counterpoise. So for that purpose, they're very effective. And the way they sort of do their magic is they're not electrically coupled to your car, but they are capacitively coupled. The magnetic mount acts as a capacitor where, you know, the manufacturer knows the dielectric material that he's using between the conductive magnet and the shell of your car. Also, what you might be thinking of is similar antennas that use magnets but are applied to the glass. The problem with those is, you know, they work fine as far as coupling the signal, but you don't have the ground coupling for the counterpoise. So those have to kind of deal with the inefficiencies of that type of antenna, and usually it implements an antenna that's not a quarter wave, but something like a half wave, so that it doesn't typically need a counterpoise. It deals with things in a weird, different way. So it sort of depends. I don't think it's really productive to do that because the efficiencies of through the glass mount antennas are not that great. You should probably consider some slight alternative to mounting it, where you can either get some counterpoise as wires that just kind of run down the side of the wall of your building and provide the efficiencies of an antenna like that, and, you know, figure out some kind of a useful mounting purpose. What a lot of people tend to do is they'll use a magnetic mount, but they'll use it in a fire escape and couple that connection to the fire escape metal, or if they have a air conditioner that goes through the wall, they'll stick it to the air conditioner, and that'll be the metal that acts as the counterpoise. Or they'll just take a cookie dish that's a ferrous and use that as the metal for the counterpoise. But I wouldn't kind of cripple yourself with a through the glass, you know, imbalanced without counterpoise antennas. That's, you know, kind of handicapping you severely.
Okay. I think what you said all there makes sense. Could you talk a little bit more about? I'm still a little fuzzy about exactly what role a counterpoise plays. What I think it is, it kind of acts like in a dipole antenna. You're sending your signal into one side of the dipole, and then the other one is kind of acting opposite that. and so the other side of a dipole, would that be an example of a counterpoise? Yeah, I'm still kind of confused about all this stuff.
AC2GS. Yeah, it's easy to become confused. It's sort of a substitute for the other leg of a dipole, and that is tend to like to be balanced. Consider it like a seesaw. A complete seesaw is a nice little toy when we were young. But imagine if some idiot sawed off one half of the seesaw. Not much you could do with that. So, you know, the current has to kind of go back and forth in order to work properly. So the concept of a counterpoise or radials is to offer a electrical a counter to the radiating element. So you could either have it be just a lump of metal, you could have it be a cookie dish, you could have it be a set of radial wires coming out radially from the base, you could have it be the air conditioner, you could have it be a refrigerator. Some people put a mag mount on top of their kitchen refrigerator, and although it's not perfect because it's inside the house and depends upon how the insulation works, serves as a counterpoise. So all these things are sort of a phantom other dipole leg when you end up using a single element such as a whip or something. So, you know, physics requires some kind of balance. So if you offer the universe just a whip, it will find some other piece of conducting material to act as a counterpoise. If you don't offer it a piece of metal, it'll probably try and use your coaxial cable in common mode to radiate. And that's a problem that a lot of hams have. You don't really want your transmission line to be an antenna and to radiate, because unless you kind of choke it someplace, it's inevitably going to land RF in your shack with computer equipment, and otherwise it's going to be very sensitive to it.
Gotcha. That makes a lot of sense to me. That helps a lot, Roy. Okay, looks like I have some research to do here, but that was really helpful. Yeah, no other questions, I don't think.
Okay, Mike, you know where to find us if you come up with any, and almost all of us have questions. I have questions. So, when the next question pops into your head, keep us in mind.
Yep, absolutely, I will.
Okay, very good. Well, next comes Rich. What's your subject for tonight? Rich, W2BZ, are you out there? I guess Rich stepped away for a second. Anyone else with any questions want to get on the list, please let me know. Hit that push to talk and ID yourselves.
Roy, I switched over to the other band on my radio, so I'm still here.
Oh, okay. What's your question or topic for tonight?
Okay, it's about pressure, and I think there's a very easy answer to this. If you stand up and you raise your hand above straight up, your hand has a certain pressure around it, air pressure. Now, if you put your hand on the floor, it's going to have a different air pressure. What is it? A purely a chemical reaction that's happening in the air, in the atmosphere, and molecules start going faster than other molecules? I never actually knew how that pressure is figured out at a certain height.
okay? It's gravity. Consider it as gravity is holding our atmosphere to the surface of the Earth, fortunately, because there have been other planets where gravitational forces were weaker and the gas is just kind of wafted away into space. But we have enough gravitational field to kind of attract the gases to the surface of the Earth. And now you have an infinite number of columns of gas. The column at the very top has very little force of gravity on it and has very little pressure. Pressure is just force per area, surface area. So as you go farther and farther to the surface of the Earth from the top of the atmosphere, the column of mass of the gas increases, and so the pressure of the atmosphere is the highest at the surface of the Earth. Somewhat in the same way that when you're talking about the pressure, the water pressure in the ocean, the highest water pressure you're going to see is the lowest depths of the ocean, where you can think of the column of water right above you is being pushed down by gravity of the Earth.
But aren't there chemical reactions also going on within the air? Aren't molecules behaving differently at one height than another height?
Well, they're behaving differently, but they're, again, behaving differently because their environment is different. They're closer to the Earth, so they feel the gravitational field greater. As you come closer to the surface of the Earth, the force of gravity increases. But there's no and you know, there's kinetic energy of gases in general. They jiggle about, and if you increase the temperature of a given gas, the forces are increased as well. So you could say that kinetic energy affects pressure and gravity affects pressure. But chemical reactions, you know, most of the atmosphere is oxygen and nitrogen with a little argon. Oxygen can oxidize a reducing agent, a fuel, you know, gasoline or what have you, but the nitrogen is very stable, and so atmosphere is a fairly stable gas, unless you add some reducing agent, like some fuel. So you don't have to consider it as any aspect of a chemical reaction. Chemical reactions are between different atoms and molecules where bonds are broken and formed and such. And the bonds of O2 and N2 are rather stable for all intents and purposes in the atmosphere.
But since the atmosphere is made up of moisture, air and moisture. What am I trying to say? I would think the chemical composition of oxygen and nitrogen would look different on the floor than it would on the ceiling.
Well, it doesn't. I mean, there's a degree of water vapor. Water, H2O, usually when we say water, we mean the liquid. The liquid isn't suspended in air much. It's mostly in the vapor phase. So there's a little bit amount of H2O, which is also is a very stable compound. You know, thankfully, you know, water doesn't explode under pretty much any circumstance. You could make the hydrogen and the oxygen explosive by separating their bonds. It's a chemical reaction. Then you have hydrogen and oxygen, and those two, hydrogen can reduce oxygen. You can have explosions and such. But as far as chemical reactions, the only thing that differs is the concentration and the pressure at different heights. The chemical constituents, the characteristics of oxygen and nitrogen and such, are pretty much identical no matter where you go on in the column of air. So, you know, pressure doesn't have really that much to do with chemical reactions. I mean, pressure and increased kinetic energy can increase the rate of chemical reactions simply because it allows you to collide atoms together with reacting other atoms. But again, most of the atmosphere is nice and neutral, so you don't usually have to worry about the atmosphere exploding.
Very interesting, Roy. I never knew some of this. If it's hot outside, the air is thinner, right, than if it's like a cool mist outside?
Well, I don't know if it's perceptibly different one way or the other. If you in a closed container, if you increase the average kinetic energy inside the closed container, the kinetic energy of the gas particles increase, and so when they hit together and when they hit the container, they have a higher force, and that force means a higher pressure. So you can change the pressure of a contained gas. If it's not contained, it'll just have a lower density, and so it will tend to, gravity will just buoyantly, you know, raise it up. So hot air rises, cold air sinks. It has to do more with the density of the gas molecules in a given volume of space.
Yeah, in aviation they use the term density altitude. I never quite understood what density altitude meant, but if you're taking off from an airport in the Rockies, you have quite a different forces working on the engine and the plane's engine and mechanical surfaces, but I never really understood density altitude. But the rest of it I get now, Roy. Thanks.
Comment, N1YDY?
Yes. Hi. Please.
Just the definition of density altitude is standard altitude corrected for temperature, and the standard atmosphere is at 59 degrees Fahrenheit, and of course 2992 inches of mercury. So just density altitude is correcting what you observe versus the standard.
Thank you, Hank.
I think I got that. But if you're taking off on a hot summer's day in the Rockies in some little strip, the pressures that are operating on the airframe and on the engine are different than if you were taking off from Islip out here. Isn't that correct?
Rich, I guess you want Hank to answer it. Hank, can you tell him?
Yeah, certainly. Yes, so getting back to Islip, if you will. So let's say it's a cool spring or fall day, it's 59 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's the definition of standard temperature. And let's also say that it's, barometric pressure is 299 inches or 92 inches of mercury, the definition of standard pressure, for a standard atmosphere right there. Even if you stay in Iceland and you're still at sea level, if the temperature goes up to 90 degrees, the amount of oxygen that is available for the engine in a reciprocating, piston-powered engine aircraft is less. And so each stroke of the piston
has less oxygen to work with, therefore you lean the mixture and you give it less fuel so that you get a complete stoichiometric burn, which is about 14.8 to 1 units of fuel to, I'm sorry, units of oxygen to fuel. So anyway, you don't have to go up high, but if you go up high at the same time that you also have a hot day, then you end up with a density altitude that could be significantly greater than the actual altitude of the airport. Denver, for example, is, 5,280 feet up in the air because, that's famously the mile-high city. And let me drop it for a second. And if you have Denver on a warm day, you could easily be over 10,000 foot of density altitude. On the other hand, if you're in Denver on a very cold day, you can have a negative effect, and the density altitude will come down, and it's not uncommon for an airplane to see the performance in the engine as if it was at a much lower altitude of, say, 1,000 feet or so in Denver in the winter, obviously only when it's very cold. So I don't know if this is helping you conceptualize what's going on, but the concept of density altitude is just a function of correcting to standard, and remember that all the performance data for airplanes is based on standard and then corrected for pressure and for temperature so that you have an idea of how well the aircraft will truly perform when it's on the runway and taking off, or landing for that matter.
So would you say that the worst conditions you could fly under are cold, like in Fahrenheit, 20 degrees from Denver? Would that be the worst conditions, the most misleading conditions to a pilot?
Well, I would think it'd go the other way. If you're in Denver, or if you want to be really dramatic, we'll call it Leadville, which is an airport in Colorado that happens to be the highest regularly certificated airport in the United States. So let's say you're in Leadville, it's a little less than 10,000 feet up in the air, and it's a hot day. It might be hot enough that you simply can't take off and expect to fly. You won't have enough lift by the time you get to the end of the runway for the aircraft to fly. So that would be the worst. If it got cold and you were in Denver or in Leadville, you're just increasing the performance. And obviously, if it's really cold in some other places that are closer to sea level, you can get stellar performance. Now, you might not want to do the walk around to inspect the airplane if it's really cold. But, I spent a winter in a place called Whitehorse in the Yukon. And it was often minus 20, minus 30, and very occasionally minus 40. And when you're down at those kinds of numbers, it doesn't matter what scale you're using, Fahrenheit or centigrade, because they tend to converge around minus 40. But the point is that the aircraft performance is rather stellar there. I mean, to the point where you have more performance than you know what to do with, because you run out of what's called available pitch attitude, which is just a big bunch of words that means on a non-aerobatic airplane that you're not allowed to pitch up beyond so many degrees nose high or so many degrees of bank. And, when you're first taking off to get the safety numbers, performance numbers for takeoff, you might end up with a pitch attitude that's significantly higher than what you're legally allowed to use for a non-aerobatic flight.
I'm sure there have been many, many pilots who have miscalculated or didn't bother to calculate the density altitude and lost their lives.
Well, again, getting to the situation where it's warm, one of the other factors I didn't bring into this was relative humidity. And humid air also displaces oxygen. Again, that concept of water not being combustible is not an oxidizer. Even though it's made up of hydrogen and oxygen, you can't use that oxygen to for performance of the engine. And so on a day with high relative humidity, you're getting less performance out of the engine. So the worst possible thing for you is if it's a little higher, or sorry, if it's a little hotter than you think it is, and the relative humidity is high, so your density altitude is relatively high, and your performance based on water vapor is decreased, and all in all, you simply run out of variables, and you simply don't know, unless you do the calculations with the charts, just how high the density altitude actually is. But yeah, you can easily get yourself in trouble in something that you wouldn't think would get you in trouble. In other words, you might go out to the airport and think, oh, you know, it's a little hot and I'm a little sweaty, but it doesn't make you think, okay, I've got to go get the calculator out and run all these calculations. And of course you should, for the obvious reasons.
Hank, one more and then I'll let you go. So it's the density altitude plus the atmospheric pressure?
That I agree.
I'm sorry, I missed that. You kind of faded away.
Yeah, I was wondering, so it's the density altitude plus the barometric pressure that you have to figure into it, right? You just can't take one figure by itself and calculate safety, can you?
Well, again, it's from that standard atmosphere that we talked about, you have to calculate the density altitude based on temperature, and then you also have to look at the barometric pressure. That's not as critical, but it's certainly, you know, you can imagine that it would be critical if you're, obviously, to get a number below barometric pressure below 90 inches of mercury, then you're dealing with what are essentially hurricane type of pressures. Now, usually that has high wind velocities and people don't want to fly in that. But assuming that it's just a really low pressure day, you could easily get into a position where if the temperature's high enough, the pressure's low enough, and the relative humidity is high enough, you're not going to get the performance out of the aircraft that you think you would. Not just the engine, which is what I've been concentrating on in my answers, but also in the lift from the wings, because, you know, again, you have the inverse square law working with the amount of lift that's generated, and if you need, say, twice lift, you put in twice as much cargo as you expect, so the airplane weighs twice as much, well, you need to have four times as much lift, and that becomes harder to generate at these high temperature, low pressure, and high relative humidity values.
Well, I think I got it for the first time. I really think I have an understanding of it. I am a I'm a serious simmer. I'm not a pilot, but I'm a very serious simmer, which the sims have gotten so good, both Microsoft Flight Simulator and I forget what the other one is, the big one, but they've gotten so realistic that you could actually learn a hell of a lot about flying, because all the buttons work, all the hydraulics work, everything works on these simulators now, and it's just amazing. It's just amazing. So I actually know the flow of from cold and dark to pushback on a 737. So the simulators have become something. Anyway, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much, Hank. You're our resident pilot. I appreciate your expertise and your willingness to share it with us.
Excuse the talk. I haven't had a chance to think about it in a while, but thanks for listening.
You're quite welcome. And thanks, Rich, as well, for your participation. Always welcome. And always you have great questions that bring up discussions of all kinds of things, so I appreciate that. Well, anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight? Yeah, just hit that push to talk. Okay, perhaps later on some people will join us and offer some questions or comments or topics for discussion. So next is Wes. You have a list of things you want to discuss?
Yes, I do. But first, talking about the discussion that was just provided by ham radio operators and the flight professional, from physics standpoint, the pressure is not a force anyway. The force is a vector, the pressure is not. But
it's a vector, but it's still, it's from a force. If you didn't have the force of gravity, if I could snap my fingers and stop the warping of space-time and just kind of turn the gravity off, you wouldn't have any pressure in the atmosphere. It would all just waft away.
Yes, I mean, it is just, let me talk to pressure as a force, to talk about the pressure as a force, when in fact it is the ratio of the force to the area to which the force is applied. So, yeah, back to you.
Yeah, I said that at the beginning of this subject, that it's the force of gravity affecting gas molecules over a given surface area. So, you know, might not use exactly words you used, but pretty much the same concept, that's what pressure is. Nothing special about it. People do have problems with the difference between contained gases and uncontained gases. So, you know, if you have a sealed container and you act upon it in different ways, you increase the temperature, then you change the pressure, you know, pressure-volume aspects. Keep the volume the same, increase the temperature, and you increase the pressure. Whereas if you talk about the atmosphere, it's not in a container. And so some people who are flat earthers kind of say, well, that disproves the whole thing because it doesn't behave like a gas in a container, because atmospheric gas isn't in a container. So this is a little bit different than conceptually. But, you know, I think most people understand what pressures tend to be.
I agree with that, Dr. Roy. Thank you very much for that. The first topic is triangulation with AOA bird spectrum analyzer versus fox hunting. So we have two methods, the one that was used for years, dozens of years, by ham radio operators. And then we have a bird spectrum analyzer that could do the same. It is actually made to do the same for professionals. So SH60S-TC is from 9 kHz to 6 GHz RF spectrum analyzer, and it costs only $10,038.
Wesley?
Yes.
The spectrum analyzer kind of uses a directional antenna as well. So fundamentally, the method that it uses for fox hunting is pretty much identical. It might be automated, and it might be able to download maps for you and draw the triangulation graphs. But it's the same sort of method. On the other hand, you know, Doppler methods of fox hunting are considerably different in detail.
Yes, I agree with that completely. The thing is that the triangulation to be done could be done with one spectrum analyzer, and then you have to move to the different location. Of course, you have to have a directional antenna, but you can download the map on the spectrum analyzer with the GPS. It gives you the vector. Back to you.
Yes, but the underlying triangulation method is identical. One is manual, the other is automated. That's the only actual difference. And one will set you back a couple of hundred bucks on a bad day, and the other one, as you mentioned, would set you back $10,000 on a terrible day.
Yeah, it's not only that. These software for it, which is additional $3,800 back to you.
Well, what can I tell you? Some people have a lot of money to spend. This is all business and government-related equipment. For the most part, only billionaires, if they want a toy, would kind of invest. Most guys into fox hunting, I'm sure if you ask them, they prefer the old draw some lines with a ruler on a map way of getting things done. We amateur radio operators are infamous for being a wee bit tight with the money most of the time.
Of course, I agree with that. The next one is, this discussion is mostly about the ant fed antennas. The two antennas in one shot, that means that was the video that I have sent to Dr. Roy, which shows the hex beam antenna of two elements for 20 meters to 6 meters, but the guy wanted to have 40 meters and 80 meters, and that's why he used the same mast to hang from one side the end fed antenna. So I would like to talk about the end fed antenna. So if you look at the email, there is a picture at the bottom. Shows the transformer connected to the coaxial cable, and then secondary, so the primary and the secondary is connected in parallel to the capacitor, and from one side you have a counterpoint, and from the other side you have the amount of wire needed for the antenna to resonate. It is actually a one band antenna, but smart people could use it for many bands with antenna tuner. The thing is that the ferrite has to be in its inductive low loss region because it is a flux coupled transformer, not a transmission line choke.
Wesley?
Yes.
I mean, that's a generalization. I know where you got it from. It's the actual words on a web page that you showed me. But that's a generalization. All balans, all impedance transforming balans have to do it before they saturate. Otherwise, they fail in their duty to transform the impedance from, in the case of an end-fed antenna, half-wave antenna, you know, 3,000 ohms to 50 ohms. So, I mean, all the transforming balance that use a ferrite ring are using it in its, low level before it saturates. The only time that you don't kind of care much about whether it saturates or not is when you're using it as an RF choke just to block any common mode radiation from your transmission shielding. So you're not really that concerned about losing energy and heat. You just want to block that RF from getting into your shack. So, I mean, that's a generalization. It doesn't only apply to end-fed half-waves. It applies to just about every non-RF choke use of a balance.
Well, actually, you're talking about every and any half-wave antenna. So the common half-wave antenna is center-fed dipole, but doesn't have to be certain center-fed dipole. Approximately, say, 72 ohms, right? And the dipole is basically monoband antenna, and it's sometimes used, it's tooth harmonic with the cox or used multiband as a doublet with balloon, ladder line, or wide band tuner. And then if we're talking about the advantages, disadvantages, so then we can think about EMI, restless reception, RF in the shark, or all kinds of devices, let me drop, all kinds of devices in the house that will lead a life live the life of their own as soon as you get on the air. And there is one, I believe, clear reason for this, and this is, as you said, a common mode current or imbalances in the supply line, but of course, if you want to talk about what is the difference between common mode and differential mode, I'll be happy to hear it. Back to you.
Okay, we've done this a few times, but it probably warrants doing it one more time as well. There's two kinds of current mode in transmission wires. The one that most of us are interested in completely is differential mode. This is where a current is going in a 180-degree differing phase between the center wire and the inner surface of the outer shield. There's, as we mentioned, there's with RF, there's skin effect. So current usually doesn't travel through the entire substance of conductors, but as the frequency of the current increases, they occupy a thinner and thinner region on the interface between the metal and the dielectric non-conducting material. So on the surface of the center wire is one current. On the inner surface of the outer shield is another current going at 180-degree phase. They null each other out, and so you don't get radiation from that. You get transmission of the current up to the antenna feed line, which is what you want. Sometimes, in some cases, there'll be reflections at that point, and the current will travel back the transmission line using now the outer surface of the sheath, and it will be in the same current mode as the inner aspect of the sheath, and therefore it won't be neutralized, and it will actually be able to be radiated just like your antenna elements, which you don't want. Most people would prefer the radiation to occur at the antenna site. That's the optimum location. By doing it on the transmission line, not only are you wasting energy into places that you might not be interested in, but it can get into your shack, and the RF can wreak havoc, probably not so much with the radio because they tend to be somewhat shielded, but we all have a lot of electrical equipment that's not as well shielded, which causes all kinds of things. People used to have garage door openers that would open and close when they transmitted on a given frequency. So that's a very quick version of common versus differential mode current in transmission lines.
Okay, and we're talking about the end-fed antenna. Then in practice we have 4-band, 8-band, 8-band. We can have, and we have a transformer. But actually the transformer is not a transformer. We have a coil on the length of the wire. We could have a coil, make it shorter. And the next subject to talk was actually the guy did that. Let me drop. Okay, that end-fed antenna. And he's got a problem. What he did is he made that coil. I sent you the pictures of it. I sent you just a picture. I sent you just a picture of the problem. So he used a rope. And everything was hunky-dory till he found that when there was humid or there was a rain, that rope reacted out as extra length for the antenna, and the antenna couldn't resonate on it. So let's say we have a typical end-fed antenna. It depends from how many bands we want it to cover. We may need 25 meters over the wire, 4-band. That would be, I should say in feet, 65.6 feet, not in the meters. And for 8-band, we need 40.4 meters. That would be divided by 3. No, times three. Okay. Anyhow, so that would be 132 feet. 132.5. Yeah. And that is how long the antenna could be. So it depends what you want to do, but the bound usually is 1 to 64. And the expected power, usually 100 watts. Don't go with 1 kilowatt on it, unless you have it done properly. Back to you, Dr. Ray.
Okay, I didn't know what to make of that guy. I'm familiar with the rope he used, because I use that rope, and the metal attachments to the rope, because I use the metal attachments to the rope. It's an Italian cord company. It's the DX Engineering sells a lot of that stuff, and I don't quite understand or believe what he said. It's an insulator. It shouldn't really act as a conductor. I guess theoretically, if you live right off the ocean and there's salt spray and it gets wet, maybe some of it conducts, but otherwise, I think it's a polypropylene or something. It's a plastic, so I'm not quite sure why a plastic, when it gets just generically a little damp, all of a sudden acts like a conductor. So I'm a little curious. And also, I noticed that there were some comments in that video that you sent me where the people say, I don't know, I do the same thing. It works fine with me in the rain. So I think we're kind of missing something, or more important, this guy is missing something.
Well, I see it this way. The guy had a problem, then he put the isolator, and he stopped to have a problem. But we don't know the dielectric properties of the rope. So what is your comment? Back to you.
In general, I do, because, again, I own the damn rope. It rained here in Brooklyn, and then the rope didn't become a conductor. So, again, I don't know. I think he was drawing a conclusion. I don't think... if you really did some sophisticated testing, you would find that a damp Mistrano, I forget exactly the name of the company, plastic rope has negligible conductivity.
Okay, possibly. It could be. I'm not saying that I gave you the case. I give you the subject to discuss. I would name it this way. But, it's good to know. It's like, you know what? It is good to know that if you have a VNA, nano VNA, or any VNA, and you want to measure your antenna first, touch the two ends of the cord together. Because you may, a second later, you might not have your VNA any longer. If your VNA costs $10,000, $20,000, or $30,000, you're still not going to have it. Even though that it costs $50, a nano VNA, you're still not going to have it. Back to you.
Okay, by the name of the rope manufacturer is called Mistrant. And as I said, the DX Engineering seems to sell a ton of this stuff. So, it'll be interesting to ask DX Engineering if you can get the strand rope wet. I would assume that given that they sell this stuff, that they probably would tell you, yes, you could get it as wet as you want to get it. But, okay, you bring up a subject, and it's sort of my job sometimes to just kind of take it and hit it over the head. So I guess we work together that way.
Yeah, I'm extremely proud of being part of your team, Dr. Roy. I do appreciate your comments. The next one, the video was named "Whoa." Micropocket SSB receiver review based on ESP32 and SI47732. That's the chipset that is there. Actually, I said that the work time is 3 minutes. I don't know if you had time to do it. It is tiny, 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 tiny things with the antenna that is included in it, working from 9.9 kilohertz to 181 megahertz. And it costs $20, if I remember, $56.60.